So how we'll start, how our morning will go, is we'll begin shortly with an arriving meditation. And then I'll offer some thoughts to get us going. And then we'll have a longer meditation, a break, and then a longer Dharma talk, and plenty of time to talk with each other. So hopefully that will go well and you'll enjoy that. So I want to invite you now to move into a posture that supports you for an arriving meditation. I love beginning this way because it's a natural way to move from our walking around daily, everything life, into a time of practice, into a time of formal meditation, internal practice. So whether you choose to close your eyes or leave them slightly open, whichever you prefer, do that. And if your eyes are open, please invite a gentle downward gaze, not looking at anything in particular. And then coming into a general sense of the body. The body in the position, the posture that you've chosen. Let it be comfortable. Please let it be at ease. Adjust any way you need to adjust so you can feel that sense of an uprightness, an attentiveness as we move in to this meditation, but also a relaxation. Holding just enough energy in the back body as you sense how the spine grows tall out of the deep low back to the crown of the head. Just enough energy to stay upright and attentive. And then softening all around that, particularly the face and the jaw, the chest and the belly. Sensing the furniture beneath you, or maybe it's the floor, whether you're seated or reclining. Notice those touch points, the place where the body is held. Letting go into that any amount. And then sensing into the breath body, the inhale, and then the exhale, the slight pause before the next inhale. Breathe and know you're breathing. And we'll begin with this most beautiful invocation into our practice. O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, remember who you are, the luminous nature of your mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. Inviting quality of refuge in home, this body, this mind and heart. We'll sit quietly for a few minutes. And as we continue to move into our practice this morning, notice if there is an intention that is arising for you, or maybe one that is already present, your intention for practice in general, or maybe your intention just for the next 2 hours or the next 10 minutes. Does it need to be anything grand, something that feels most natural to you? See what bubbles up. Notice it, welcome it, and then come back to the body and the breath. And as you're ready, open your eyes, come back into the room. Oh, welcome back, everybody. So today I want to explore intention and how intention is supported with commitment, and how intention and commitment are further supported by determination. And so we'll explore those three aspects of practice today. And we'll begin, let's just begin with intention. And there's so many ways to think about intention. And of course, I'm thinking about this, it is the new year, and it's always appropriate to think about it, intention. And sometimes when things are busy, not even necessarily difficult or exciting, but just in the natural busyness of our lives, it's helpful to come back to that question about why am I doing what I'm doing? What is my intention here? It can be the larger intentions. It can be the smaller intentions for an interaction with somebody. Why am I here? What is it that I hope to convey? All kinds of things that the way intention can come around. Wise intention, the second on the Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught, is comprised of metta and compassion and letting go, a renunciation. That's just a little bit of an aside if we were to think about what is wise intention. But within metta and compassion and letting go, that's all about love and letting go, right? And our practice is about how do we cultivate love ultimately? How can we let go of so much? Where is our grasping? Where is our clinging? And so much is dependent on what we think, what happens in the mind, what are the actions of the mind. So I've been thinking a lot about this piece from the great Cambodian teacher Mahagosananda. And there's this teaching that I want to share with you as a way to begin today. He was known as the Cambodian Gandhi. In the 70s, during the Cambodian Civil War, he lost all of his family to war violence. And yet he was able to not allow hatred to take over him. He actually made a practice of walking across Cambodia, teaching metta, teaching everybody to metta, not to let ill will take over. And so here's the teaching from him. And I think, Carlita, can you put it up in the chat? Great. So this is a piece that some of you may know, and it's a profound teaching. And here's how it goes. The thought becomes the word. The word becomes the deed. The deed develops into habit, and the habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of respect for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. Have you heard that before? We're going to read it a few times because it's a very, very profound teaching that can really shift our relationship to what I think often comes out of my mouth and what I say, and it conditions what I do. So the thought becomes the word. The word becomes the deed. The deed develops into habit, and the habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of respect for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. There's so much in that, isn't there? So let's take that apart a little bit. To begin with, we're talking certainly about how does the thought become the word? Where does the thought even come from? I don't really know. I mean, that's the great question of what is consciousness itself and how are thoughts literally formed by the synapses and whatever is happening in the electricity of the brain. So I wouldn't even begin to say I know where thoughts come from. But what I do know, and I think you know, is what are the experiences that we have that stimulate a thought? And typically it's from contact of some kind. So we see something beautiful, and then there's a thought process. We see something difficult, thoughts arise. So thoughts arise in response to contact. And this is where the Buddha taught about Vedana, the experience of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. This is the second foundation of mindfulness. So when you have an experience, you come in contact with something, there's a pre-verbal thing, to say it's a thing, mind activity, that happens where we get the sense, I like it, or I don't like it, or I don't really care, right? That neutrality, or it doesn't really, I don't want to use the care. It doesn't really strike me either way. And if you think about it, we can pretty much characterize or categorize all of our experiences somewhere along the continuum line of extremely pleasant, pleasant, kind of neutral, doesn't really affect, you don't notice the effect, into getting a little unpleasant, more unpleasant, to extremely uncomfortable and unpleasant. That's just true. And this is the beauty of this teaching, because when we have this internal, maybe subconscious sense of something is pleasant or unpleasant, the thought arises, and then we often have something to say. And so we speak our thoughts. And then out of these thoughts, out of what we say, oftentimes there's an action that follows that. Are you with me? How this is, you can see how this is an equation that works, but it's not a one-way equation. You know, we might do something and say, wow, that was wonderful. And then it stimulates a really wholesome place in us. And we go back to, you know, that it's pleasant. We have a thought, we do something, we say something, we have this interaction. And within that, when we bring our mindfulness into it, the awareness of what is happening, then we can be truly present with it. And what I believe Mahagosananda is saying here is it is so critical that we are in tune with the workings of our minds, because the workings of our minds, what we think and what we say and what we do, do become habit. The things that really support us, that we love, and that we intentionally make habits out of, we want to know those things. And we also can create habits out of what we find unpleasant. And that can, it's not that we don't want to know unpleasant. We definitely do. We just want to watch how contact, how experience affects what we do and what we say. And this training of intention, the training of what we are exposed to, has enormous influence on our habits and how that becomes part of who we are. So this second stanza that says, so watch the thought and its ways with care, right? When if you're having a bunch of disparaging, difficult thoughts, notice their consequences inside of you. And notice if that's helpful to you or if it's not helpful to you. And we deliberately shift our thoughts. If you have a string of disparaging thoughts, mindfulness, the work of mindfulness is to learn to let that go, to not let the sour mind become more sour, because that's what happens at the around the neurons, right? Neurons that fire together, wired together. The more we think about what's wrong, the more we see what's wrong. The more we think about what is unpleasant, that's what we can cultivate. We're reinforcing those neural pathways. And I'm not, again, saying we shouldn't notice what's difficult. Of course, we do notice that. Otherwise, we'd have our heads in the sand. But we do want to intentionally shift towards thought processes that cultivate wholesome action, wholesome habit. That's the practice of wise effort. So I think that this is a beautiful piece that helps us begin the year, begin the new year, to come back to remembering, like it says in this invocation, remember who you are, your luminous mind, the goodness of your heart. Trust it. Return to it. It is home. And even if our training is in some difficulty in some way, even if we have, you know, we have some of us have glass half full, glass half empty. So those of us with glass half full, you know, notice if we're also being realistic, if everything is always too optimistic and we're losing a little bit of balance, because either of these can be out of balance. Or if you're a person who is naturally glass half empty, always see what's wrong. We need to ask the question, what else is true? And we've talked about that before in here. What else is true is a beautiful question for bringing us back into balance. So watch the thoughts, watch the speech, notice how it impacts your habits, and then choose. Use your mindful awareness. Use it for agency to choose how you want to show up. And that's why I think this is such a beautiful, beautiful piece of intention practice. Do you have any questions on that or comments? Anybody? Okay. So I want to begin with that, and we'll move now into our longer meditation. So once again, please find a posture that works for you, and we'll have about 30 minutes here. So whether you're on the floor, seated or reclining, or you're in a chair or any kind of furniture, notice that. You may even choose to do some walking meditation during this time. And that's fine. So let's settle in. And once again, closing the eyes or not, whichever you prefer. Knowing that we always have a choice. One of the ways we cultivate resiliency, resiliency meaning our ability to manage our lives exactly as they are, without losing our balance completely, the ability to regulate the nervous system, is using the power of choice. What do I expose myself to? If there's pain in the body, you don't need to sit and just grit your teeth through it. Adjust. If you're having a very busy, chattery mind, just know it, chattery mind, but try not to judge yourself for the busy mind. This is how it is. We don't need to put up resistance unnecessarily. We give ourselves a choice of what we pay attention to. And this builds capacity. So dropping down into the body now, noticing the touch points, the places where the body is touching itself, maybe eyelids, lips, the insides of the upper arms, touching sides of the torso, the hands and feet, grounded in the body. Noticing the breath. Simply breathe and know you're breathing. Nothing complex to do with it. Just noticing the inhale and the exhale. Pause. The whole breath cycle. And now you may notice the motion in the body in response to the breath cycle. The expansion of the chest and the belly. The rise and fall of the shoulders and side ribs with the breathing. Just notice. You also may notice sound. Sounds nearby or further away. So wherever you feel most inclined to rest your awareness, be it the body, the breath, or sound, choose one of those and see if you can stay there. And in the staying there, there's a balance that gets cultivated. The mind becomes clear and actually rests a little bit. And when the mind goes off somewhere else and you notice it, you know it's not a problem, but with a little gentle persistence, come back over and over again, begin again, right here, right now. And let's sit quietly. If you're noticing any holding in the body, tension arising or tension that's been with you, begin by noticing it. Notice its characteristics. Maybe there's an ache or a sting or some sort of pulse. Whatever it might be, there might be a size to the discomfort or a texture or a color. And if you can, bring a little fresh breath, a little bit of ease to that area, any way that works, a little softening. And then let it be and come back to your focal point. Now ask the intention to soften. You might be noticing a little bit of stillness arising as the mind and the body and the heart all begin to settle into the same place at the same time. Just noticing any amount of ease, peace, stillness that are arising. Welcome them. Let them be a refuge, a place to rest. Keep going. And then as the settling deepens, if you can, inviting this settling, the stillness and ease to expand in the body. Wherever you feel it most, see if it can expand from there to fill the limbs, the legs, the feet and toes, the arms, hands and fingers, the entire torso, all the internal organs, spreading up and through the throat into the face and the head, pervading the entire body, all the way out to the edges, remembering to breathe. And through the breath, with this stillness pervading the whole body, sensing how every inhale brings in fresh energy, fresh air from outside of us. Every exhale sends it back out. The exchange of energy through the breath, through all living beings, happens without us doing anything about it. It's the natural order of things, the natural course of breathing, the inhale and the exhale. And if you like, imagining that with this breath, with each exhale, the amount of stillness, ease, and peace that's been cultivated inside of you expands beyond the inside and surrounds you. This internal awareness becomes part of the external experience as well. And we can know internal awareness, external awareness as one. Sitting here, quietly, with stability and balance, inside and out. And now becoming aware of the heart center, the center of the chest and the upper back. And as you place the attention into the heart center, Just notice what might be there today. Maybe there's a physical sense or an energetic sense of it. However the heart is, can we let it belong just as it is? And taking the same practice of internal and external awareness through the breath, taking it into the practice of the heart's breath, imagining breathing in fresh energy into the heart space, exhaling, releasing heart energy back out, in and out of every direction, the back of the heart and the front, above and below, sides and diagonals, nurturing this whole heart space, increasing its capacity, spaciousness, even its tenderness, befriending it. And as an intention practice, to deepen our intention practice, I'll offer you today some compassion phrases that help us connect to the work of the heart, of cultivating wise intention, of loving kindness, compassion, letting go of that which we can. So repeating to yourself, silently, and if you like, putting a hand on the chest gives a physical, tactical sense of the heart center. I like doing that. Go ahead and do it. May I accept myself just as I am in this moment. May I accept myself just as I am in this moment. May I surround my limitations with respect and care and love. May I surround my limitations with respect, care, and love. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May I be supported with strength, steadiness, and courage. May I rest in the beauty and goodness of my awakening heart. May I rest in the beauty and in the goodness of my awakening heart. Now we'll move into our traditional blessing practice, our metta practice that we do together as a group. And you're welcome to unmute and say who you're thinking about. This will naturally unfold. You'll see if you've got somebody you would like to speak into the room for or about. And just unmute yourself as you're ready, and I'll begin. I'm thinking about new life, the ways in which new life can thrive and endure and has strength even within difficulty. I'm visiting my kids who have a 10-week-old puppy, and it's very enlivening to be so fully present with a baby, even a dog baby. And it gives me a lot of excitement and hope about new life. Who are you thinking about?
I'm thinking with gratitude and compassion for healthcare workers everywhere who are entering the third year of dealing with just incredibly difficult working conditions. I don't know how they do it, and I'm very grateful that they are continuing to do it.
Yeah. And then to that, Nancy.
I'm thinking about my mother-in-law, who is 101, and she's starting to have hallucinations, and I can see the distress that she's going through, and she is unaware that this is happening. She believes these hallucinations are real. And I'm reading more and trying to be more open to accepting her and her issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
I'm feeling what a great blessing it is today and every day to be able to hold both the really good and the beauty in the world, and also the beauty and the goodness and sadness in hard times and the balance of that, and to be able to hold both of them equally and with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of all the children who have been affected by the new variant of the virus. I've heard there are many, many hospitalized children. And so I'm thinking of all of them, that they will be comforted and surrounded by loving family members, if at all possible.
Mm-hmm.
And with loving and attentive healthcare workers, of course, too.
Thank you. Thanks, Cindy. Did you want to say something, Cindy?
Yeah, I'm thinking of new life, mm-hmm. a family friend last night, kind of a niece, a surrogate niece, had a baby girl last mm-hmm. night, mm-hmm. and a safe, healthy birth. So, and again, I, like you, really feeling kind of joy at new life
mm-hmm.
and their pleasure and their joy at having this little girl.
mm-hmm. Thank you. Who else? I love how we can share meeting of the joys and sorrows. Tom, please, I see you down there.
I see you up there. Well, I like to send metta, have the groups send metta collectively to my sister who has dementia, and she's in a memory care home. And we Zoom with her on Wednesdays, but sometimes she's just not there. She's totally out of it. And today she was a little bit more responsive. And also for my friend Jim, who was paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair for going on 40 years now. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Tom. Barbara, it looks like you're unmuted.
Yes. I'm thinking of, I have many friends struggling with serious health issues. Mm-hmm. I am daily trying to support, listen, send blessings, and a few people have been passing away right in this last couple weeks close to my community, and I know that's happening everywhere. And I am feeling, I feel grateful that I keep coming back into my own grounding in my own body. And some days it's harder than others, but I feel grateful.
Beautifully said. You know, all of this joy and sorrow that we meet as best we can. And if we can stay in our bodies, this is a real thing. The groundedness of the body, the reliability of the body, even when the body may be having limitations. Probably there isn't anybody here today who doesn't have some sort of physical limitation. That's true. But the body does support us. It gives us so much information, and we can really listen. And this is a practice that we're cultivating, deep listening, which helps us show up. It really helps us show up. So thank you, everybody. The metta, this group metta, is beautiful and it's important. It's a really important part of what we do together. So let's say it's 5 after the hour. Let's come back at 11 minutes after the hour. Let's take an extra minute today. See you at 11 after the hour. Well, welcome back, everybody. So one of the things that I think about frequently in the study of the Dharma, or the study of anything, but specific to our practice of the Dharma, is sometimes I think, I experience the teachings as very beautiful, and they are. Some of them are confounding. Some of them I don't understand. Some of them feel very natural. But one of the questions that comes to me frequently in my practice is I'll get the thought that says, well, that sounds great, but how do I do it? How do I make this real? And I think what's so important for practice to me is that it becomes not conceptual, not just a good idea, not just a beautiful sounding teaching, but how do I actually do these things? So, in our invocation, O nobly born, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, remember who you are, the luminous mind, the kind heart. Trust it, return to it, it's home. How? You might have that question. How do I keep trusting it? How do I keep returning? What are the tools, the practices, the reminders that I need so I can actually be able to do that? Because as we all know, life's hard and life's joyous. But how do we remember? How do we remember to remember? This is the cultivation of mindful awareness. But back to this other piece from Mahagosananda about watching our habits so we can create habits that support us. Here's a piece that I found that I enjoy very much. And this is a 7-part, it's called the Monk's Manifesto. And maybe you know it. And it's something I like to come back to at least once a year. This Monk's Manifesto came from a woman, an Irish woman. Her name is Christine Walters Paintner. And she's the abbess of an online abbey called the Abbey of the Arts, which is a monastery without walls that offers classes and resources to nurture contemplative practice and creative expression. And it's written from a very, for me, what feels like a very sort of, I think, a Christian perspective. And I've adapted it to, I think, a more, just to me, it's a little bit more accessible. I've removed some of the language that I just don't relate to, but I know I've taken some liberty with that. So you can get the original from the Abbey of the Arts. And so as we read through these, see if there is one or two that really resonate for you, and then we'll come back to it. So number one, I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude to make space for another voice to be heard and to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. Number two, I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both within and without. I recognize that when I make space in my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. 3, I commit to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom I can share my deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. 4, I commit to cultivating awareness of my kinship with creation and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy and things and letting go of what does not help nature to flourish. 5, I commit to bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts in the world in meaningful ways. 6, I commit to rhythms of rest and renewal through the regular practice of Sabbath and resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. 7, I commit to a lifetime of ongoing transformation, recognizing that I'm always on a journey with both gifts and limitations. And we'll pause and stop it there. So I wonder, was there something in there that spoke to you? And I can read them again. And Carlita, I'm going to find that piece and send it to you.
Wonderful.
Does anybody have any response to this? All right, well, I'm going to talk about them.
Great, excellent. Oh, all right. Pam has her hand.
Yeah, Pam, please. And then Peggy.
I was really struck about the commitment to community and finding kindred spirits. I really liked that. But I also think that sometimes you can build community, a bigger community, by also finding souls that aren't quite so kindred, that are a little bit different, that they bring a lot to a community as well.
Such an important point.
Yeah. So that's all.
You know, yeah, but you know, I want to expand on that with you a little bit. It's so easy to be with those who are like us. So easy to connect with like-minded people. And when we have the courage to be with those who we don't understand, or we might have very, very different views, and have the capacity to say, I want to understand more about your view. That's really courageous. And you're right. And so are we kindred in a different way?
Mm-hmm.
No, we can redefine kindred.
Yeah. Because their views may be a little different than ours, but their hearts ache in the same way that ours ache.
Exactly.
That's and right. So we're all human in that way. And we form community in that way as well.
It's so true, because if we only stick with people who think like us, we get isolated and insulated. That's right. And I think that this is what the Buddha meant when he said, make my heart a refuge for all beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not easy.
No, it's not. It's not.
Thanks, Pam. I'm really glad you started with that. Peggy.
So I realized, like I heard again, the one about busyness, right? And making enough space for different parts of yourself. And I remember about a week ago, I started just like, okay, no distractions, just sort of silence in the house. And I just realized that I had a lot of I think a lot of loneliness that came up, mm-hmm. and I use noise and things to, I don't know if it's to keep myself company or to keep myself from feeling that loneliness. And so that's just what came to me as I was listening. I was like, oh yeah, that's that reminder again.
You're so right. You're so right, because we live in a culture that's noisy, and that defines us by what we produce. And we go against the stream when we turn off the stimulation. And then we have to retrain ourselves in being with ourselves. And that's, you know, that's what we do when we come into silent community in the meditation, where we can tolerate the silence with each other. And I do think that we're very accustomed to filling space. And do we need to keep ourselves company? How do we keep ourselves company? That's the other question in it. And so what a great place to start, you know, to say, all right, I need to turn everything off in the house, and then to watch how that is for you. And I hope as you did that, that there wasn't judgment about, oh, I need some noise. I mean, just like, oh yeah, you know, I want to listen to some music or whatever it is. There is a loneliness that happens that we train in loving that part of ourselves as well, to notice the empty places and our need or our inclination to fill it, because it's hard. Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. Thank you. Vivian, hello, it's nice to see you again.
I can totally relate to what Peggy was saying. I mean, that's not what I was going to talk about. I have something else to say, but I totally relate to that. The silence, and then watching what it does to me or how I react. And it's a process. And I've been trying to have a lot of silence in my life whenever possible. And I'm really cooped up at home. I'm not one of these people who wants to go out and take a chance with Omicron. I don't think I'm in the right physical shape for that. Mm-hmm. But the part that really struck me in the Monk's Manifesto is about solitude and silence.
Wow.
Because I guess for a long time, as a result of beginning to study Buddhism, mm-hmm. and all this information, okay, I started noticing how wound up people are in what they say, you know, especially the concept of self, no self, and how generally, and I certainly have done it and I do it, but I'm getting away from it, defining ourselves by our words and our thoughts, and we take it so seriously, or maybe I should just say I don't anymore. And take it quite as seriously. But I just happened to notice yesterday when I was on a big Zoom call with about 12 people having a discussion, and some items came up where there was an issue that needed to be solved. And the issue got solved in not more than 5 minutes. And then everyone spent another 15 talking about the issue. And I'm sitting there watching, and it's like, you have totally said what you need to say.
Yeah. Isn't that an interesting thing?
And so I've also noticed this in myself, and I'm trying to get away from it. And to some extent, I do. So the solitude and silence is like just amazing to me. I think it's so, so, so important.
And this is part of what we're doing here. I mean, I agree with everything that you're saying. And we can start watching our own speech practices where we fill in space.
Yeah.
Right. And we can use that practice of wait, why am I talking? Right? Why am I talking as a practice?
Yeah.
Thank you, Vivian.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Who else? Anybody else? Jason, Hello.
Good morning, Heidi.
Good.
You know, it's funny, just in listening to what's being said, I was thinking of one of my favorite lines from a member of a 12-spec program. And one of the favorite things they say is, "Your actions are so loud, I can't hear your words." And it occurs to me that speaking is an action. And sometimes the simple act of speaking too much or needing to be heard negates the message, if that makes sense. You just can't.
Totally does. It completely does. Yes. And this goes back to the thought becomes the word becomes the deed. So we're connecting these dots. And if we can trust what we're saying, trust ourselves, we don't have to shout. You know, and sometimes it's hard to feel heard. That's also true, right? So when we work with what else is true, what is still true, might be that one has a pattern of not feeling heard, not feeling seen. And that pattern, that behavior pattern, might go to speaking quickly, needing the last word, speaking loudly. But oftentimes when we speak quietly and deliberately, others stop and listen. Isn't that amazing? You're muted again, but I can read your lips. That's okay.
Well, actually, most people want to mute me in any event. But you know, but what I find is a lot of people hide behind their words.
That's right.
You know, there's that bias where you don't really want to integrate a give and take. You just hide behind them, your true feelings, your true thoughts. And so what I've learned is to try and keep my mouth shut. Another expression is, a fish would never get caught if it kept its mouth shut.
That's beautiful. So this is the practice. This is part of pausing, right? This is part of the mindfulness practice. What am I thinking? That's one weight. Why am I talking? And then go to these aspects of wise speech. Is it truthful? Is it helpful? Is it kind? But also, is it timely?
Right?
And to have our speech meet all four of those can be tricky.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard work. And we go again, we're going against the stream of the culture.
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Victoria.
Yeah, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for everything and confess that I got pulled away at some point. I don't even remember exactly when, but I was wondering if you could just go back to at the very beginning, before we did the meditation, you were talking about intention, determination and commitment, or was it commitment and determination? And I was just wondering if you could like give a little, I mean, the intention part was the main part of the Dharma talk today, and it was fabulous. But I was just wondering if you could say a few words about commitment and determination. I mean, how they all relate. I'm assuming the commitment part also came up in the manifesto. And so, I'd love to get a little connection. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yep, we're not there yet. So that's correct. So we talked about intention, and this section on the manifesto is on commitment. What do I commit to? What is important to me here? So let's just look at this manifesto again. I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude, okay? To make space for another voice to be heard, to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. So this is really important. This is all about how we commit to meet our intentions. So we're going to connect these dots. This is like a three-legged stool, and we create balance when we have each of them. The second one, I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming all parts of myself, the stranger inside of me, the stranger I don't know. And I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. That's also a commitment. Committing to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, but also to making space to hear somebody else's opinion, that commitment. I commit to cultivating awareness of my place in the world, my kinship with creation, and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy. And this is the place of renunciation. How do I let go? What is my impact in the world? I commit to bringing myself fully to the present, fully present to the work I do. Whatever it is, can I show up? Am I committed to that? And this piece of holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts. We all have gifts. And do we have the courage to bring them forth? That's a commitment as well. Do we know what they are? Commitments to rhythms of rest and renewal, right? This is why we do this practice, is also the way in which we internally rest. Things get stirred up. We get renewed. We do this over and over again, the practice of Sabbath. And we commit to being on the path, a lifetime of transformation. So there's much to say about this manifesto. And, you know, thank you for asking that. And it looks like Carlita's attached the version that I use that I've brought in here today. So again, I said earlier that we start with intention. Our intentions are supported by commitment. What are we committed to? And I also said earlier, the question comes up of how do I do all of this? How? And the third part of what I want to offer you today is the third part is through determination. The third part is determination, because intention arises. Here it is. And then we have an intention to go in a certain direction, but we need to be committed to that. The commitments are multifaceted, but then we need some juice underneath the intention. We need that energy that is underneath the commitment. And that's this source of determination. And it's a gentle persistence. It taps into the wisdom that we already have, this inner knowing. And so I want to talk now about some determination and how this works. And I will do this through a piece from Sylvia that I so love. Now, determination is one of the paramis, and the paramis are translated as the perfections of the heart. The fully mature, expressive heart includes things like morality and wisdom and loving kindness and truthfulness and determination and wisdom and renunciation. Generosity is first on the list. And I want to talk about determination and read you a bit of a story that Sylvia wrote. And this is her book called Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. It is a book that I go back to over and over again. It's one of my beloved books and teachings from Sylvia. If you haven't read it, I can't recommend it enough. Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. And it's a whole exploration of the heart. So here's the story. Oh, hang on. I got to change glasses. Otherwise, I won't be able to see it. All right. This is called The Powers of Practice. My grandson Colin's sixth grade teacher invited me to visit her class and talk to her students about the Buddha and meditation. They were completing a social studies unit on India. I was eager to present mindfulness as non-mysterious, sensible, and useful because, first of all, and most importantly, it is. Also, because I'm Colin's grandmother, I wanted to appear regular. Mindfulness is about paying attention, I told them. Think about how useful it is to be able to concentrate here in class. It's much easier to finish your assignments, isn't it, if you aren't distracted by the people around you? I saw that all 26 students seemed to be smiling, nodding, and agreeing. And, I continued, when we pay attention carefully, we make wise decisions. Do you know what wise means? more nodding, more smiling. My grandpa wasn't not wise, one girl said. He kept on smoking cigarettes after he knew they were bad for him, and he got sick. Other students joined in with stories of people they knew who were or weren't wise. I heard, one boy said politely, that people who meditate can tell the future or know your past or even guess what you're thinking right now. That's true, I responded. Some people do learn that skill by meditating, but mindfulness is about paying attention. I also heard, the same boy continued, that people who meditate can walk over hot coals or lie on beds of nails. We saw pictures about them in our book. That's true too, I answered. Sometimes people concentrate so hard that they don't feel pain in the way we usually do. Then they can do those special things that you saw in your book to prove how concentrated they are. Mindfulness is different. Mindfulness is paying attention in an ordinary way. Colin said, he went on, that you once met a woman who was such a good meditator that she could walk through walls. Did you? I did, I said, laughing, appreciating how polite and persistent this young man was in pursuing his point. She was old when I met her. She'd lived in Calcutta, but some of her students, who were my teachers, brought her to the United States so people here could meet her. Did you talk to her? He asked. I did, I said. Did you see her walk through walls? No, I didn't, I said. I guess I thought if my teacher said she did, then she did. How did she do it? He asked. I saw that everyone seemed very interested. Well, I'm not exactly sure, I replied. But what people said was that she concentrated so carefully that her molecules all dissolved and she could pass through walls and reconstitute herself on the other side. Everyone nodded as if that sounded reasonable. The questioner seemed content, and so the conversation continued onto questions about how to concentrate. We did some mindfulness exercises, some sitting still with eyes closed, some standing and moving. Everyone seemed pleased. I had a good time. 3 days later, a large envelope arrived in my mail with 26 thank you letters. 25 began, Dear Sylvia, and one began, Dear Grandma. And all of them were very enthusiastic and thoughtful, citing particular parts of my presentation. I especially enjoyed when we stood up and did mindfulness moving around. I like the stories you told about the Buddha. What I've been thinking about is how I can tell that I'm not paying attention when I'm not paying attention. And one letter said, Dear Sylvia, thank you for coming to visit our class. I enjoyed everything you said, but I'm still thinking about that woman who concentrated so hard she could walk through walls. And I've been wondering, what if she got distracted in the middle of walking through the wall? Would she get stuck in the wall forever? Yours truly, Robert. I loved Robert's letter. In addition to being charmed by his uncomplicated, non-challenging, but nevertheless sincerely interested curiosity, I was delighted by his image of the perils of distraction. I realized how frequently I get stuck in walls. I get stuck in walls of lust or desire, thinking, if only things were otherwise, then I would be happy. Or I get stuck in walls of anger and resentment when things don't go my way. If I'm not careful, I begin to create scenarios of ever so subtle revenge, which further fatigue my mind. And ultimately, when I realize what I've been doing, they humiliate me a little bit. Every day I bump into mind walls, walls that feel solid because the impact is painful. Only when I remember that the walls are the habits of my own mind, that I built them and they will continue to exist as long as I insist that they are real, can I stop building. Then my mind relaxes and I see clearly. I see that the walls are empty and then I walk right through them. I also admire Robert's determination. He persisted as long as his mind was confused. Sometimes when I'm teaching far from home and people who know me through my books will ask, how does it feel to have a clear mind all the time? And she says, I wish I knew. My mind is like everyone else's mind, falls into habitual, predictable traps. I get confused. And practice is not about never getting trapped. It's about recognizing the traps and choosing freedom. If I pay attention, I won't get stuck forever, and I'm determined to do it. Isn't that a beautiful story? And it's very poignant about how we do get stuck. We do get stuck in the walls. And it's just such a sweet story about what happens if you get stuck in the middle of the wall and all of your molecules are dissociated. And will you never get out of that wall? So how does that happen for us? And it does. So we come back to understanding our intentions and our commitments and its relationship to determination. And there are many ways to tap into refueling our determination. One of them is being willing to stick with it, to have enough oomph, enough commitment, enough knowing this practice is beautiful and good, that we come back, enough self-love to know I can begin and I can keep going. There's a wonderful story one teacher once told me about one of her students who had lost a lot of his confidence in himself and in the practice, and was in one of those times of being stuck in the wall. And they were working together about how to get unstuck. And she offered him many different practices. And mostly, I think what she offered him is her companionship as his teacher. He didn't leave. She didn't leave. She was there, and they worked through it and worked through it, came back to the intention, the commitment, the determination. And one day he came to see her, and he had tattooed on his hands, on one palm, it said, "I love you." And on the other palm, it said, "Keep going." So he could look at his own palms and see, "I love you, keep going." Can we cultivate that so deeply in ourselves that when doubts arise, when we get scared, when we don't feel connected, we lose our intention, can't find the commitment, starts to waver, and the determination maybe it isn't so strong. What are the tools we need to keep coming back over and over again? When we're frightened to know that, you know, the story of Mara, in Buddhist mythology, Mara was the tempter, the one who kept saying to the Buddha, "You don't really want to become enlightened. Who do you think you are to do this?" And the Buddha would say, "Mara, I see you. I see you, Mara. You're not going to scare me." So when the voice of doubt arises, and we can see it as that, the inner critic, the inner judge, the voice of doubt, "Mara, I see you." And we come back to what we know is true inside of us. "I love you, keep going." We connect with kindred spirits because these kindred spirits are Sangha members. They support us and give us the strength to be with those who might not think just like us. But we come back and we begin again. Over and over and over again. One of my very favorite teachings around this comes from a Zen teaching that says, when you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. I think I'm very literal, and I often see words in my mind, and I see those kinds of images, and I think about falling down as a kid and scraping my knees and pushing off the ground in order to stand back up. And I still have got scraped up knees. But we do get scraped up, and we learn, and we come back and we begin again, and we trust the ground of the practice. So this is connecting the dots of intention and commitment and determination. And we need all three. We need all three. I want to end, and then we will have a couple minutes to talk with each other. Actually, I want to say one more thing. It was true that, if it's true that the Buddha's penultimate instructions to his students as he was dying, the story goes that he looked around and he said a couple things. One was, remember, all things are transient. Whatever is of the nature to arise has the nature to cease. Right? Everything changes all the time. And then he said, strive on with diligence. Strive on with diligence, which has also been translated as move into the future with confidence. just the next breath, you can take the next step because of your intention, because of your commitment, because of your determination. Move into the future with confidence. Love yourself and keep going. And here's a poem from Mark Nepo called Being Here. Transcending down into the ground of things is akin to sweeping the leaves that cover a path. And the heart of the journey, the heart of our own awakening, is to discover for ourselves that the leaves are not the ground, and that sweeping them aside will reveal a path. And finally, that to fully live, we must take the path and continually sweep it. So we have just 5 minutes left. I hope this has been helpful for you. Anybody have anything in the last few minutes you'd like to bring in? Jane, please.
Heidi, I just wanted to say best wishes for the new year, first of all. And just nothing specifically. I just really wanted to thank you for today's talk. It really touched my heart.
You're welcome.
And I love your... the quotes and the things that you bring into it. And one thing that really struck me today was when you said there's something that's not quite right with ourselves, whether it's, I forget the word you used, but to give it respect and caring mm-hmm. and love. And you also mentioned sometime in their talk that we all have something, we all have some physical thing that, because we're not perfect. and I think that's just so important, because it's so easy to just say, if only I didn't have this backache, or so-and-so doesn't have a backache. Why do mm-hmm. I? But to give it the respect and the caring and the love. Yeah. So thank you for everything, but especially thank you for that.
Thank you, Jane. You know, what would happen if we lived in a world that was so giving that we could all honor our limitations and our challenges with that care and respect and love? It would change our culture if we could start from that place, that we all have these limitations. And whoever said we weren't supposed to, like this externally imposed idea of perfection, that we wouldn't have any of that, and the harm that I think that that has caused us internally and externally. So we know that about each other, right? We know that each one of us has got some sort of something that we're working with. We don't have to know what it is in each other, but we know it's true. We know it's true. And in that place, that our common humanity can meet. And I think that's what we're doing. So thank you, everybody. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be with you. As always, I'll be back next month. And I don't remember the date, but it's on the calendar. And I hope to see you somewhere along the line. May you all be well. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. Take good care, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.